then Arthur will carry it along. There's an oral history interview with Norman Hackerman on the 12th of March concerning the Gordon Research Conferences. The interviewers are Arnold Thackray and Arthur Demrish. And Norm, I guess we're interested in starting with your interactions with Neil Gordon and your knowledge of Neil Gordon, who seems a kind of interesting guy.
He was a member of the faculty at Hopkins while I was a graduate student. I remember taking a preliminary oral with him in the room. My impression is that he was a man of high intellect, but not a great chemist. He used to have to study beforehand when he asked questions on the orals about chromium or manganese, or he always asked questions out of the group he happened to be in the freshman class. And we knew that, and all we had to do was look at that group, and that meant we had one point settled. That was good. But I did get to talk to him quite a number of times. I found him an extremely interesting individual with great ideas in a variety of ways, the Gordon Conference being one of them. And I remember him talking to me about him on occasion. I didn't go to the early conferences in Gibson Island, but he did talk to me about him. And I thought it was a first-rate idea to get academic and industrial research chemists together talking about the edge of the field, whatever area it was. And it seemed to me that the idea of the conferences were first-rate. You come, you talk, no attribution, no copying, no pictures. You just took away what you remembered of it and used it in your own work. And it certainly worked in the early days of the Gordon Conferences. I don't think it works now. I think it's much more normal kind of conversation, not the kind where you let it all out. Of course, you know it's not going to be stolen or used or whatever. And Gordon's idea, I think, was originally just that: talk and walk away.
He was a professor of chemical education, which was
an unusual
thing in itself.
Well, he didn't do any research. He had no research activity, and he had started a journal of chemical education already by the time I got to meet him. The conferences themselves were a form of chemical education, not formal, not low level, but actually informal and high level. So it's an extension of his other interests.
Classically, of course, Hopkins had been such a great research university. And how did he sit with his colleagues?
He probably was ostracized a bit. It's a little hard for a graduate student to know how those guys mixed. But I've already told you, when he came into the orals, he was prepared for a certain kind of question, because that was where he was teaching freshman chemistry. And the other people were freestylers. They asked questions that, you know, came out of the blue. You didn't know what they were going to do. So I would say that I'm sure they got along personally all right, but professionally, they probably didn't.
Well, why were you interested in him? Why did you connect with him?
I can't remember, as a matter of fact. Well, I do remember one conversation we had. I was about to finish, and I was concerned about getting, this is 1935, concerned about getting a job. And I went to see him, and he started to say to me, well, I don't know about a job, but, and this plaster began coming off the ceiling, and we had to run. When we got out in the hall, he said, "But you've been put up for Phi Beta Kappa." And I thought that was a non sequitur. As it turned out, I did get a part-time job, but not through him. Other than that, I didn't really have... it was required that we go around to all the faculty members before we took orals. You know, I did talk to him at that point. I talked to him about a job. And how we got to talking about the Gibson Island conferences, I can't tell you, I don't remember. But I was in his office talking to him. And he'd already started the conferences. I think there were 31. I was still an undergraduate in 31.
Gordon got involved with the Hooker Scientific Library.
Yes, he did.
Which I know nothing about.
Well, he talked to me a little about that. He had acquired it with the original intent. Now, this is kind of a guess. The original intention of bringing it to Hopkins, but I think he was at cross purposes with Hopkins already. And he took it with him to
Center College in Missouri.
And I know there had been some, you know, the buzzword was there had been some talk of bringing that. Hooker Kresge,
I think it gets named Kresge when it moves to Wayne.
Is that right?
Okay. That's when.
So it was Hooker Chemical Company up in Buffalo, up in Niagara Falls, I think. But that was all corridor conversation.
Yeah. So the when did you first get to a Gordon Research Conference?
It would have been in the late 40s, or maybe 1950. Corrosion Conference was my steady one. I also was involved with the Interface Conference for over a fairly long period of time. And I was involved with the Electrochemistry Conference when Bacchus started it sometime in the 70s or 80s, I can't remember which. I chaired all three of them at one time or another. But corrosion was the steady diet.
Just before we move on too far from Neil Gordon, I'm curious, how much did people talk about his ability to raise funds and kind of launch these new initiatives?
I never heard any conversation at all. Fundraising wasn't actually a title back in the 30s. First of all, the number of dollars available was absolutely minimal. I guess Gordon was precocious in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, funding was limited, but he raised $100,000 for the library.
And I never could understand that. So those were the days of 10-cent corned beef sandwiches, you understand.
That was an extraordinary feat at that.
Yeah, it was. How you separated those people from the money now.
And indeed, the Gordon research, the conferences from the earliest moment, there's always a sort of funding aspect to them.
The industry paid for that. They were wise enough to know that they might get something out of it. So I think they're the ones that supported. They certainly sent their people. I can't tell you about the Gibson conferences. I knew a few people that went there. I never went to one of them myself.
What was the buzz about them? What was the buzz about them, the corridor conversation?
That here were some 30 people fairly high in their fields of catalysis or corrosion. I think catalysis, corrosion, hydrocarbons must have been the first three of these things, something like that. High in their fields, they're sitting there on the sand for a week and talk to each other. I wonder what they're talking about. That kind of thing.
Because you have to be invited.
You have to be invited. And you have to be willing to stay on that sandy spit for a week, for 5 days at least. And it wasn't comfortable. A few people I know that went to the first ones, Herb Ulig was one of them. I don't know if you know Ulig up at MIT. He said it was lots of sand flies and hot as a devil, no air conditioning, and in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. But they sat around their underwear and talked. And it was very successful, apparently. That is, the transmission of ideas really worked. And that's because there was not another thing they could do. I guess they could go swimming, but that's all. When it moved to New England, and Gordon actually didn't have much to do with that at that point. When he moved to New England, they scheduled morning and night sessions, and he played golf or tennis in the afternoon, so it became a vacation arrangement, which brought on the first fuss that I remember up there. People brought their families, and then they didn't want to listen to anybody talk at night, because they had to be with their wives or their kids or both. And we had a hell of an argument one night, I remember. Maybe we ought to fix it so only the participant can come, nobody else. And that was voted down.
And the night meetings continued.
And the night meetings continued, but they became less and less effective because you'd have a good morning meeting, then you'd go out and be in the sun all day or go swimming all day, and you have kids to play with and deal with. And after dinner, you didn't want to talk anymore. You're tired. You want to sleep. So it didn't work. And I think it became less effective, as a matter of fact.
You were talking earlier about your being down in early days in Texas, and that's the time at which you also first go to a Gordon
right.
conference. Do you know who got you invited, or how? How did that work?
Hello.
Oh, John, hi. We're just coming in.
We're just having to introduce the introduction
of John Haas.
Thanks for coming over.
We've been doing Welch Foundation. We're just talking about the Gordon Research Conferences now going back into Gibson Island in the 1930s.
This is an exciting place, and you can add to it. I just wanted to say hello, but certainly not interrupt what you're doing. I don't have to be out here.
Okay. All right. Thanks for stopping
by.
Thank you.
Sorry to see you.
You've got to get in now at the back.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, John. You have to pick up our... John's been our staunch supporter since before the day we began.
Does he visit here pretty regularly?
Yes. Mm. Yeah, he's still... Quite engaged, and he's a major influence in this town. He's really been a very sterling guy. Play us the last.
We were just talking about your kind of first conference, which, from our records, is around 1950 when you first directed the corrosion conference. I don't know if you attended one before that.
Yeah, I must have, or I wouldn't have been in it. My guess is I went there in 47, 48, something like that. You were asking about an invitation. I don't know. We didn't have to be invited. they announce these things and you applied to them, and somebody selected you and you showed up. Now, who the chairman was, and I think the chairman of 47 or 8 must have been Herb Hewlett, because he would have been the one that would have got me in there.
We've got Compton and Dennison.
Compton out of Bell Labs, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see the list.
They go by year and ask to see if they'll scan down for
a
year.
Yeah. Dennison I knew, Compton I knew briefly. Copson was Nickel Company. Burns? Oh, and I knew Bob Burns quite well. And he may be in the one that got me. Yeah.
Corrosion's a subject with such obvious industrial importance, and the early Gordon research conferences, my sense is they were had pretty strong industrial
Absolutely.
Involvement.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were set up to do.
Mm-hmm.
High polymers, catalysis, petroleum, textiles, corrosion, medicinal, vitamins, so on. All these had direct connections to the outside. And what happened after a while is that it became a little more esoteric.
Well, in those early years, they were able to bring people from competing companies and competing labs.
Absolutely. And they talked.
They left the bias behind, so to speak.
Well, I don't know if they did, but they talked. The fact is, there were a few people who just sit and listen. The attempt was to get everybody to say something. The size of the corrosion conferences was generally in the order of 50. And the things wouldn't make money. They'd lose money. And then we'd get complaints from the management, we've got to do something, invite 70 next time or 75 or something. So it became money-driven after a while.
50 is a lot of people to have in a kind of an informal discussion. How did it work at that?
It worked in the formal sessions, and it worked in little groups. After the sessions, we each had bottles of whiskey that we had stashed someplace, and four or five people
session?
Would get. Huh?
Is this the morning session or the night
session? No, night session. Okay. After the night session. There'd be four or five people of common interest get together and sort of hammer away over a drink. And that worked pretty well. But in the main session, where there are 50, sometimes as much as 100, it was the job of the chairman to try to drag everybody into it, you know, by saying, "Hey, Joe, what about it? What do you think?" And we knew each other pretty well, wasn't it, that the group?
So was somebody, you're chairing the 1950 Corrosion Conference,
mm-hmm.
So have you fingered a series of people to each to speak for half an hour? Or
No. You started off and you don't say, you speak. You ask a question. You ask Bob Burns, "Well, you're an old timer in this. What do you think about the such and such a metal in this system? What would happen? What's the chemistry of the metal?" And he'd generally respond. And if nobody else picked up, you'd call on somebody else. But not to give a dissertation, just to answer a question. So it was, you had to know everybody in there. You had to know what they knew and what they could talk about. And that's about it. You know, we had a blackboard. I think we might have had a projector, slide projector, and that's about it.
You're in a classroom, basically, or a lecture.
Yeah, at Colby Junior College up in New London, New Hampshire.
How much correspondence went on beforehand to kind of map out what topic areas would be covered? Corrosion's potentially huge field.
Well, the several people who were involved with the management of the current session would have a rump meeting to decide on who the chairman of the next session would be and the vice chairman, if I think that's what they're called, assistant. And that person would be given the task of determining the narrow field that they want to deal with. It came a little more formal later. In one year, there would be wet corrosion, and the alternate year, there would be dry corrosion. And that was because wet corrosion sort of overran the place, and the dry corrosion guys didn't like it. And they said, if you want us to stay here, you're going to have to let us talk about our kind of corrosion rather than your kind. That did happen. In the interface field, it was much more dependent on who was in charge. And in fact, I see Langmuir here, surface phenomenon. That's what led to the interface.
How as chairman did you get the right people to come to the conference?
The same people came every year, just about. And the trick was to get a few new ones. And that you had to do by knowing the field and knowing who the new guys are that were publishing. And if they didn't ask to come, you call them or ask them, hey, don't you want to participate in this great activity? And that was true of all three of the ones I dealt with.
So did you have to make the discussion work every day?
Yeah. Well, some of them after a while began to get field leaders, so to speak. Pick somebody out of the crowd and ask them to chair. In my case, I did it the whole way through. I didn't waste my time playing golf in the afternoon.
The companies who helped sponsor it, would they then send specific people, and what role did they play in terms of framing questions for discussion?
Well, they sent people who they knew, their own people that they knew were interested in the field. But I don't think they tried to frame questions. I think it was a catch-as-catch-can, that they depended on their, quote, representatives, unquote. They were not representatives, but the obviously were also more representatives at the same time. There were supposed to be white knights talking about difficult problems. And to extract from it whatever they could of value to their company. I think that's the way it worked.
But without
being formal about it.
If I'm a Union Carbide, how would you persuade me to pay for a conference that's going to profit the Dow guys?
No, just you're a good citizen.
And that went over okay?
That went for a while. I think it broke down. I think the current conferences don't do what Neil Gordon had in mind. The current conferences are just another lecture series. And in fact, there are more people. First of all, they have well over 100 of those conferences now, because that's what it takes to break even or put a little money into the general kitty. So you can have the kind of discussion we used to have. Our problem at that time was to shut people up so we could get others to talk. Because it's inevitable that some people just take over the podium and say the same thing at least a dozen times, maybe. Currently, you don't have that problem. Most of them come and sit tight-lipped. They probably have a hidden recorder someplace. They take pictures, which was never permitted at that time. And it is a formal lecture system in a nice setting. New Hampshire is a nice place and so on.
Was that a gradual shift over time?
Yeah, but the shift was complete certainly by 1970. It was already evident in the 60s. And then they spread it. It's all over Asia and Europe. And it's a big business in a sense.
Did you, as going back to 1950, were you expected to make the thing break even, or how did that work?
Well, they called you when they didn't get enough people in the house. Because somebody had to make that money up.
What about the industrial funders? Who got them? Did you have to do that?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember doing it. I don't remember going to any industry and asking them for them. So it must have been the staff. Now, see, that staff was also a problem. For a while there when was I on the board? Sometime in the 50s.
You're on the board 70 to 73.
Oh, that late. There was a fiscal problem back in that era.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was an abrupt shift of director.
And George Parks was the guy when you were...
Yeah, he's the guy who sort of ran it into the ground.
Can you talk about George Parks?
I don't really know a whole lot about him, except that the place was almost busted. Whether it was bad management or worse than that, I don't know. Cruikshank cleaned it up, got it straight, and began to make it work. He was a good manager, and I think Parks just wasn't. Parks probably thought it would run itself, but alone it'd be all right. That's not the way it works.
In some of the early years, it was affiliated with AAAS.
And then that's right. It did have an affiliation.
And then that somehow drifted?
AAAS didn't add anything. So there wasn't much point to it. And the AAAS is not really, at that time, is not an operating entity.
Mm-hmm.
It is now, but it wasn't then. So AAAS is primarily science.
There's an interesting thing that just as you first were getting interested, it was called the Chemical Research Conferences for just a little while.
Yeah. There was another set of conferences that the chemical AICHE ran. I remember talking to a number of them because they were all interested in corrosion. But it didn't last long. It disappeared after about 5 or 6 years.
That was in that... When was that?
Well, in the early 50s, middle 50s maybe, and the... held their conferences in different parts of New Hampshire. I remember going to two or three of them. I can't remember the names of them. Franklin, is there Franklin, New Hampshire? And they had the same kind of problem. They'd have 30 or 40 people there, and it wouldn't carry its weight. I guess the CHE was beholden to make up the difference and didn't want to do it anymore. That's probably why it disappeared. maybe where the problem with the AAAS was. The conferences were interested in the AAAS as a moneymaker, and the AAAS was not interested in providing money for the conferences.
Were those AICHE conferences similar in format?
Yeah, yeah, they were copies. I said AICHE, I'm not sure it wasn't the engineering. What's a general engineering society?
There's an United Engineering Foundation. Or
no, that doesn't sound right. It was an engineering group, mm-hmm. I know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can look into that.
Yeah.
You went a couple of times, and then did you go back every year? How did you?
Yeah, I was there just about every year, all through the 50s and most of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. You know, you got a lot of other things going on by the.
Yeah, but I would use this. I'd drive my family to Baltimore, where I come from. Drop my wife and kids there, and then I'd just go up to New Hampshire. Of course, I was one of the vigorous opponents of families. I couldn't afford to bring them up that way. But it was almost every year, I know.
Now, at some point in the mid-50s, Gordon Research Conference is incorporated as an actual non-profit.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, was that kind of a noticeable event?
Not to the users.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that formality was important because they were handling enough money so that the feds were interested.
Mm-hmm. Were you the business in the 50s and 60s of kind of want to have conferences on, and it was self-evident there should be a continuing corrosion conference, mm-hmm. against.
No, there were discussions. Now I'm jumping forward to my board experience. There were discussions as to which ones we should drop, which ones should go on alternate years. In the case of corrosion, we did the alternate years by wet and dry. So there were two really different conferences. People came in the wet years, didn't come in the dry years. And vice versa.
So was there a significant industrial attendance difference between those?
Yeah, very different.
Which way did it happen?
Well, the people doing high temperature work were interested in the dry stuff. The others, the ambient temperature was generally wet. They're all fluid, but some was condensed, some wasn't.
How did the industrial involvement begin to change, and why?
If you look at what's happened in the last few years, you can see an extrapolatable system. The interest of the industry, which peaked in the 50s and 60s, interest in research peaked in the 50s and 60s, began to diminish rather rapidly in the 70s when it became evident that you couldn't make a direct connection between an outcome and the research that preceded it. That there was a very convoluted path that got you to the outcome. And I guess people decided if it's so convoluted, it must may not even exist. So why are we spending 10 to the 6 bucks on research laboratories? And now 10 to the 8 or 10 to the 9 bucks. So we'll cut them out. And they've cut them out. There aren't. General Electric probably still has some kind of a lab, but I don't think anybody else does. Not many others do. DuPont certainly doesn't have the same kind of lab it once had. And the American cyanamides and the whatnots are all gone. I don't think Dow has the same kind of lab it used to have. It used to have a 350, 400 person, relatively pure research lab, where people did what they wanted to do and somebody learned how to fit what they found to Dow's principal occupation, i.e. making money. They don't do that anymore. I think they outsource it to the universities somehow.
Then, I mean, but the, in that very point, the interface of academic industrial becomes even more important,
yeah.
Right?
Well,
it seems like this was...
As an extracting device, it becomes more important, yeah, sure. In fact, one of the reasons, one of the last reasons for maintaining research laboratories in large companies was to have people who could understand what was going on and do the extracting.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have to do the research themselves. That doesn't work either. The academic institutions aren't a good source of the kind of research that the companies need. They're a good source of the start of the long stream that becomes a technology. Mm-hmm. It starts up here in the mountains where a little stream jumps around and goes this way and that way and the other way. And you got to be down where the river is fairly straight before you can use the technological. And the interim is what's missing, seriously missing. And in the 50s and 60s, in the golden years of science, the companies put money into the top part of the system, big money, and it didn't pay off. Notably, that the accountants couldn't relate it to the outcomes. That's the problem. So they've all disappeared. The system goes on. How it goes on is not quite so clear.
Well, there's a very considerable concern today in the classic chemical industry about the lack of innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the industry squelched the innovation, the in-house innovation.
Well, one of the interesting things about the university academic and industry kind of divide or stream, as you're just depicting it, is a lot of times it's not so much just products, but new methods that come out of the universities.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much of the conferences was about sort of methods of doing research versus talk of specific
what the outcome really was. I don't think very much. I think it was, you know, what do we know that's different?
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly true in the... I actually attended about 5 different conferences. And that's the way it was in those 5.
Mm-hmm.
I never went to hydrocarbon. Or I went to catalysis, but not hydrocarbon, things of that sort.
And those were each sort of 3 to 5 days long? How long?
5 days.
5 days.
Come in on Sunday night and leave Friday after lunch.
Was there, if you think about hydrocarbon or catalysis as opposed to corrosion, was there a very different kind of ethos in the room? Was a different mix?
No, they were about the same. The ones I went to had roughly the same formatting. Somebody would say something, somebody would ask a question, somebody would say that's wrong, somebody would make a comment. It was very much a round table discussion with 50 people, which is not easy.
That's an art form, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an art, and it's gone. It does not exist anymore.
But it became enculturated for a while.
For a while.
In the 50s, what were the ratios of academics and industrial people in the room?
Not far from half, with the industrials being lesser, but not far from half. And it got smaller and smaller, with even the time I was there, which ran to about 1970. Although I chaired an electrochemistry one in the 80s, I think, sometime.
Mm-hmm. Did the board, when you were on the board, did you worry about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a major problem. We had money problems, but the major problem is, you know, what's the future of this outfit? Since the number of industrial people was diminishing slowly, the openness was diminishing rapidly, and it was becoming a lecture series rather than a discussion. And I think they have that problem big now. I'm guessing, because I haven't been involved with it.
What sorts of things were you trying then to adjust that balance or to kind of change things around?
Well, we'd root around and ask the Dalles and the Carbides, why don't you send more people around?
Mm-hmm. But, and their responses?
We'll think about it, you know, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were beginning to get the feeling that they didn't need their science establishment.
That they could pick it off the shelf.
They could find it some other way, yeah.
Yeah.
And they may not be wrong, as a matter of fact, but they... That's why I spoke of the golden age in the 50s, 60s. Those research laboratories were big.
Mm-hmm.
And they used up a lot of output, university output. A similar thing is happening with the pharmaceutical industry now. What's different is that the pharmaceutical industry is just trying to get new compounds with characteristic properties.
Right.
They're not, none of them are doing research on how you do this. They get that from the university guys. They know what they want. Of course, it has this kind of folding, unfolding characteristic or whatever it is. And they call on guys like Stoddard at UCLA, this is what we want. How would you make it? And he tells me.
Yeah, I mean, their end of pipeline product is always the same. It's a medicine.
It's
an injection, whatever.
Right.
The end of pipeline product for Dow can be anything from a fabric to,
yeah,
you know, a huge array, right?
Mm-hmm. Or Agent Orange.
Right.
So it's quite different now. And that's probably one of the reasons that the number of people going into for PhDs in chemistry is diminishing.
Well, the number one employer of chemistry degrees
is
pharmaceutical company.
Yeah.
Now, was there kind of a push to take note of that and move into a medicinal area a little more?
You mean
the GRC?
Yeah, I'm sure that you find some of these
older
titles.
Mm-hmm.
See any offhand here. Microbial deterioration, now that's a materials problem. I don't see anything here. 62.
Now you're on the...
Mm-hmm. This is just the 50s.
Yeah, these are just older ones. So,
yeah.
You were on the board right at a time when Parks was stepping down and Cruikshank was kind of taking over a bit more. What can you tell me about Parks in terms of what he was like as a person?
Well, the system was failing and he was pretty defensive about it.
Mm-hmm.
he probably was the cause of it. I don't know. I mean, you got to start with the chief and work down. Cruikshank was his assistant.
Right. From about 47 on, right?
Yeah. And he stopped the leakage. That's the best I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Brother Parks didn't pay attention to the activity or didn't think about it very much. I don't know. But Alex was able to fix it in a hurry. Because
mm-hmm.
in my term, that thing appeared and disappeared. And they haven't had any trouble since. Now, Cruikshank stayed on for a long time.
Yeah.
I think they've had a couple of threes since he left.
He was on until 93, and it's been Carlisle Storm ever since.
Has he been there since?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He still is. Yeah. Now, Parks brought a lawsuit against GRC at one point.
Yeah. There was strife. Everybody pointed fingers at everybody else. I'm not sure the money was well accounted for one thing. I don't remember whether they had a formal accounting firm working for us or not.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to guess, I'd say no. Of course, this was an academic affair
mm-hmm.
run by academics, and it had the looseness of the way academics manage things. And that meant that Parks was in full charge. The board probably didn't say much.
Right.
But when it became evident that there wasn't enough money to run, then the board woke up. And we're lucky, because Cruikshank was an important character in the GRC.
Now, I mean, if the institutions, I mean, I hate to use these words, but all but bankrupt circa 1970, and Cruikshank steps in, who does he turn to?
Well, first he stops the leakage, whatever it is. The conferences were well established up in New England, and they had some in Wisconsin, I think, at the time,
mm-hmm.
or someplace a little west. So what they probably did was run the conference up to 110 instead of 85, and got a little dough to plug the leak. My guess is that's what they did for about two or three years.
Right.
I know we complained about the increased numbers,
mm-hmm.
but there was no way around them because you had to have the money. Going to industry would not have done it. They were not that interested to just put Bill up to keep it running.
Right.
I don't think they felt that they were getting enough out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is they did it by increasing the size. And that in turn affected the quality, diminished the quality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have several hundred of these currently each year.
Yeah.
And they are bringing people in, so that somebody must like it. I think it's just a matter of being used to it. And I shouldn't really comment on the more recent ones because I haven't been to them in the last 10 years or so.
As it started growing in the early 70s, would they sort of institute smaller breakout sessions or were people
not formal.
On their own?
They did it on their own, yeah.
Right.
Which was a good way to do it. It was informal and means that people of like interest got together.
Right.
Again, I'm talking now about corrosion.
Mm-hmm.
But I would guess it was the same with the other stuff, too.
Right.
The current GRC is probably, except superficially, not the same as to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That was purely driven by the interest of the 4 or 5 dozen people around.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm sure it's much more formalized. As I've already said twice, I'd be very surprised if everybody participates in terms of saying something. And I would have to extrapolate that they shouldn't exist too long, much longer. But the fact is they do, and they seem to be prospering at the present time.
Yeah, I mean, they're in a period of rapid growth of that, right?
Yeah.
In terms of the number of conferences. And as I understand it, I mean, they follow the same mode of allowing people to propose new ideas, right?
Yeah.
New areas.
Yeah, they do that.
Now, in the corrosion, which you're most familiar with, to what extent would you, in the conversations during the meetings, kind of map out subfields, like, you know, here's an area that nobody's really done anything on, let's go into it?
What we generally would do, one or two afternoons during the session, the senior guys would get together and sort of map out what the next conference should consider.
Mm-hmm.
The next conference might be 2 years away because we have this alternate system.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try to identify some younger guy who would be capable of handling the conference, and then put him in a corner and see if he wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then start on the work with the understanding that in 2 years there could be some major shift, some real change in direction,
right,
which had to be watched for. That's about the way it went. Fairly informally.
Mm-hmm.
That always put it in the hands of the seniors, which is not necessarily the best way to get innovative stuff done, but it's anyway.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, did you have a sense coming out of some of the meetings, you know, God, this is exciting, I should change my research direction, and I should start working on...
Absolutely, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I guess the best example of that is the first time I heard about a good solid state, solid state electronic potential step.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could reliably set the potential and keep it from raining. Because one of our big problems in trying to do electrochemistry is to maintain that constant potential.
Mm-hmm.
Not constant on a voltmeter, which was insufficiently sensitive to see the rain. Because that potential bar was very important, and in fact was the reason that a lot of these things took place and we didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer was, yeah, now I can go back to my passivity studies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good potential stats, I guess, were somewhere between 55 and 65. And my first introduction to that was at a Gordon conference. I can't remember any other time that made a change.
And then, I mean, you'd also kind of have a list of people you could talk to about it outside of it, right?
Yeah, and people who had the capacity to tell you something about good electronic systems.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I Actually, there are a lot of smaller things you can take away, you know, little tips of how best to use a probe, what means could you, what kind of system could you use that minimized the resistance path? Was it really possible to hold the probe electrode within a micron of a solid surface without any motion at all? That kind of thing. In fact, I guess you get lots of tips on how to do experiments just by sitting around talking to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a great, you know, a great outcome from the Gordon Conference. Get right down to it, maybe that this small group talk was a lot more important than the group. Well, the big group, when it was handled well, and the discussion flowed around, used to turn up lots of little nuggets.
I'm
sure of that. I get the question now is, suppose the Gordon Conference has disappeared overnight. Would it make much difference to the scientific community? How much of a white water would there be? With the change in the way people transfer understanding, with the use of the web, for example, you might be able to get away without a noticeable change.
Well, tell me something. Circa, you know, I mean, from 1950 through the mid-70s, when you're really kind of deeply involved in it, you could make the argument that people transfer findings through publications.
Yeah. They did, but it was always a year late. Took a year to get a paper out, at best. So if you wanted to be on the real forefront, you had to talk to people who were doing it. Now that's not true.
Yes. And so you say now that's not true, but at the same time, even in that period, if you wanted to present new findings when you were talking, I mean, if you went to a conference, you'd use slides and overheads.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd bring someone to your lab and do a demonstration, mm-hmm. right? None of that's going on at GRC, right?
None of that's going on.
In the sense that it's not about visual display or demonstration. You're not running experiments.
Mm.
If you're going to talk about a new method, you're not showing it to anyone. You're describing it, right?
Yeah. Well, but it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a change. The change now is that papers can appear the day they're accepted.
Right.
Now, you may not be able to find them. That's possible. That's one of the problems with the current system. But you don't have to wait a long period of time before they're available to read.
Right.
So, of course, there are also other changes. There are papers on the web that have never been reviewed by anybody.
Yeah.
And I don't know how easy it is to know that.
Yeah, it's not at all.
And if they haven't been reviewed, then your chances of being misled are greater.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the Gordon conferences, the conversation was not reviewed either. And you have to take your chances on being misinformed. So you have to depend on your own gut to tell you what to do. But that's all right, I guess that's legitimate. At the present time, the difference is that there's nobody actually discussing what the person is lecturing about.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the discussion was a form of peer review,
mm-hmm.
which did exist then in the 50s and 60s, but doesn't now.
Yeah, I mean, if you stood up in the mid-50s and said, the way in which I can get this probe to be so and so many microns from a surface is by doing X, someone's going to stand up in the room and say, that's bull, I've tried that.
Sure.
Right. Now tell me, how are you able to leave them and implement new things in your lab without people having done visual displays based on just the description?
The description must have been enough because the few things I can think of this offhand, we did. And we did it when somebody using their hands described the gizmo.
Mm-hmm.
We did it just this way.
Right.
So there must have been enough insight transferred to permit me to copy the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way I know it would be. Because there was no paper transfer. Nobody fiddled it on a piece of paper.
Uh-huh.
The board was always erased. We never got pictures of it. I mean, that was the catechism that we got when we came in, and Cruikshank would come around and give us the word. This is what we can do, and this is what we can't do.
Now, would he come to each of the conferences when it was opening and announce that?
I went to, yeah.
Yeah.
When they got so numerous, and obviously couldn't do it all.
Right.
Maybe board members went. I don't know how they do it now.
What exactly would he say? Do you remember the sequence?
Well, he'd set down the rules,
mm-hmm.
The rules of engagement, you know, no pictures, no attribution, that kind of stuff.
Right.
That's it. It'd take about 20 minutes to do that.
Okay. And the sequence, that there were morning sessions, afternoons off.
Yeah, about the timing, when you could have meals, and what you could do in the afternoon and so forth, places to go.
Did people all eat together?
Housekeeping stuff.
Yeah. Did everyone eat together?
Yeah. These are generally colleges,
mm-hmm.
and they use the dining rooms. And breakfast from 8:30 and that kind of stuff.
Now, once they had multiple conferences going on at the same time at the same school, were people interacting?
No, they didn't do that. I think they each went to their own,
mm-hmm.
own location.
Right.
And they had about 20 in New Hampshire when I was. I'm sure they're well over 100 now around the world.
Mm-hmm.
They had an air of informality about them, which probably still exists, but it's not as informal as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. At what point did they start having more formal talks?
I think it started in the mid-70s when the industrial people lost their verve for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly was there when I was on the board. But we still had lots of informality.
Right.
And that took me through, what, 73 or 76?
Yeah, 73.
And the Gordon Research Conference board was also fairly informal. We had a rendering of how much money was coming in, how much was going out, but no account. We didn't have an accountant, we didn't have an audit committee, none of that
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I bet they do now.
Well, and there were certain traditions also, kind of nighttime activities, right? Ringing a bell at midnight.
It depended on where you were.
Uh-huh.
Some of them had such things, some of them didn't. Some of them had good beds, some of them didn't. Some of them were those hard cots, you know, that college kids sleep on. I'm trying to remember, some of them had plush quarters that people could pay for, additionally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Colby was all vanilla, all one kind.
Right. Dorms.
Stark. Colby Junior College. It's not a junior college anymore. I don't know what it's called. Do you know what it's called now?
No.
I think it's called Colby Sawyer College.
Mm-hmm.
Sawyer was the headmaster when I first started going up there.
Mm-hmm.
I actually found him very useful. And I'm trying not to be an old fogey and say it's no good, because it's not the way it was.
Right. At some point in the early 60s, 63, they started holding conferences in California.
Yeah, I went to a few of those, as a matter of fact.
Can you compare
them? And they spread out. They,
mm-hmm.
The conferences I went to in California were first an electrochemistry conference, held up in Santa Barbara, I think. And then there was an education conference. What's the name? Pauling.
Linus Pauling?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Let it off, and I gave the second paper. It was about 10 years ago, maybe.
Uh-huh. Do you know who organized it?
Funnily, Cowley, I think, had something to do. He was a member of the board at the time.
Right. And the main topic was chemical education?
Chemical education, yeah. And I remember that Pauling was interesting. His main complaint was that textbooks had great margins. They just get rid of the margins and have smaller textbooks, it would be better. That's what remains with me. I'm sure he said more than that. And the reason I don't remember much of what he said is that I followed him and I made a statement that some high school chemistry teachers are failed chemists. And man, did I get booed. I mean, real loud. There were a lot of school teachers in there.
Uh-huh.
They just raised holy hell. They were right. I mean, that was not a good thing to say. But I forgot what Napoleon said, of course. That drove it out of me. That was at the start of people trying to do something about high school science,
mm-hmm.
teaching of high school science, and chemistry in this case. But it was a whole conference. It was on the West Coast. It was Oxnard or someplace like that.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Standard Hotels, the Holiday Inn or something like the Holiday Inn.
You know, when they started in California, they started using hotels then, right?
Yeah.
Did that change the atmosphere, the feeling?
Not, well, I didn't go to many of them, but mm-hmm. I'd say not drastically.
Right.
The hotel I was used in Santa Barbara was a motel or a courtyard kind of thing. It was pretty good, except it had a railroad train run down the middle of it. In the middle of the night, too. Well, it wasn't very pleasant.
Now, the format of the education one? Same as the other?
Same as the other.
Uh-huh.
Morning and evening.
Right.
With the time in between off.
Right.
It was big. There were probably 120 or 30 people in there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was a modern one, so it was not losing money. I think Alex was out to that one. He managed to get a lot around to quite a number
mm-hmm.
of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been before. When did you say retired? 93?
Yeah.
So it must have been before that.
Right. Now, do you know Carl Storm?
I've met him, but I don't know him.
Right.
I went back. They had a about 3 or 4 years ago. They had a anniversary, and I don't know what.
They did a 50 years in New Hampshire anniversary some years back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this was in Boston at Logan Field, the hotel that's,
mm-hmm.
I don't know who runs it now, but
right.
Probably Holiday Inn or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had a retrospective, and some of us talked about Gordon, some of us talked about the other conferences.
Right.
Is there a history of that? I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's this, the 50 years, is this the one you're meaning? That's the... Look at that front page. I think it says where it was held.
Yeah, it spoke from 55.
You're right, the Ramada.
Yeah, Ramada Logan.
Right.
Yeah, see, Perry was on the board with me.
Mm-hmm. Where did he work?
Perry's at Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
Barry's at Cornell. Huh. started with the 70s. McCullough was on, he was a mobile research chemist.
Okay.
Over all kinds.
So, would you, I mean, you've known these people, you've stayed in touch with them their whole careers?
On and off.
Uh-huh.
Thacker, I know because he's at A&M now. Cowley is the guy I told you, I think, was running that education thing.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the one.
And 1990 is the first one outside the U.S.
Yeah, I guess in Europe, right?
Italy.
Right.
Have you been to any of the overseas ones?
Cali goes to a lot of them. He had a lot to do with setting them up.
Mm-hmm.
And he's at Texas. He's my squash partner.
Oh, okay. That's William?
Alan Cowley. C-O-W-L-E-Y.
Okay.
He'd have a lot of information from the 70s on.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to him next.
Yeah. He would be a good source.
And, let me see. Well, I mean, there's some more general issues about it. GRC's role in public education and public understanding of science, right? I mean, it's gotten active.
Which was not in its original charter.
Yeah. Can you say, I mean, what is it doing in that area?
Well, the Chemical Education Conference I told you about, I think that runs every year.
Okay.
Public understanding of science, I don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, walks away from the industrial involvement.
Right.
The education part.
Right. How do you see that mission drift?
How it fits?
Yeah.
Well, it's just like the Welsh Foundation. We find that you have to go back into the educational background to produce both public understanding and a steady, thin stream of people
mm-hmm.
to do the work.
Right.
So you can't be independent of the source.
Right.
And it's important that that the thin stream not be broken. And it is a thin stream.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be thick. The only problem with being thin is it's easier to break. The involvement of the conferences, I think, is legitimate. It is true that you have to have that. And the way you get around the industrial involvement is to substitute for teachers. So you have a meeting between teachers and chemists. How does that help you get better chemical education? That's the question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that it continues to run, that doesn't tell you you don't have the list of when the first education conference was. Well, this doesn't go by. It's got to be 1990.
Yeah, there was past conferences here, but there's no specific education listed. No. Education in Materials Science, 1998.
Education?
In Materials Science. You look most of the way down the page.
That's not it.
Yeah. No, that's more recent.
Yeah. I wonder what they would call it. come out of chemical.
Now, other than Alan Cowley, who would you recommend we sit down and chat with? Would be some other.
Have you talked with Alex?
Krupshank? Yeah, we had an interview with him. Do you stay in touch with him?
Hmm?
Do you stay in touch with him?
I haven't talked to him in about a year.
Uh-huh. How is he doing, do you know?
I think all right.
Okay.
I wonder what the devil what title was. I have to remember that.
Well, we have the we actually have the GRC archives here in the basement, so we can look that up.
But this suggests that it's not continuous.
Yeah.
And I thought that it was supposed to be on every year. Callie should be able to tell you about it.
Right.
He was involved with it, I know.
Okay, I think we can wrap up.
Okay.
Unless, do you have other comments, suggestions?
Well, if I do, I'll give you a call.
Okay.
Can't think of anything offhand.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, this is yours.